I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, hi. Welcome to Nature Biotechnology's first Rounders podcast. My name is Brady Huggett. I'm the host of this show. You probably know that by now. If not, maybe you're a new listener, in which case, welcome aboard. The guest today is Neil Kumar. He is the co-founder and CEO of Bridge Bio, a company that was founded in 2015. They had a sizable IPO in 2019. They raised almost $350 million. And they are set up as I'm not going to say new, but a sort of tweaked business plan, which has changed the investment proposition for investors. They've de-risked some of the issues around drug development. And one of the co-founders is Andrew Lowe, who's an economist. And I found it fascinating to think about the way they are trying to run this company and the way they're trying to run this business. And that's kind of why when I was thinking about, you know, well, would Neil be a good fit for this show? I thought, yeah, I think there's a lot of things about Bridge Bio that are interesting to think about, not only about the company itself, but about greater trends in startup formation. And the way you have a good interview is sometimes someone comes in and they are unguarded and open to talking about anything. And through the conversation, you get down to some sort of truth about who they are as a person, which then informs the way they see the world, which informs the way they run their companies. It informs the way they tackle complex biological questions. And a little bit of that did happen here with Neil. But also, sometimes what makes a good interview is a robust exchange of thoughts and ideas. And I think that's what happened in the later half of this interview. You know, I just got to sit with Neil and ask him, why is Bridge Bio built this way? It looks like it's built this way for these reasons. Am I wrong about that? What does this say about the future of venture capital funding? What does it say about the risks inherent in biotech? Really good conversation. I came away, you know, thinking about things in a different way. I learned some stuff, and that's how you know you had a good talk. Anyway, that's how I know I had a good talk. I hope it's also interesting for you. And also, just on top of it, what a nice guy. Really enjoyed talking to him. I think that's probably all you need to know. So here it is, your first Rounders podcast with Neil Kumar. Listen up.
Yeah, sorry about that. I got in early today just so I could take the round with this. But I had to reinstall the audio driver on my computer because it's just all goofed up. So that's
sorry.
That's all our fault.
So, but you're saying that you get up at 4:30 for your kids?
Yeah, I usually get up at 4:30. So like my kids, when they get up at 7 or so, I can have breakfast with them.
I got it. Okay. You get everything out of the way early and then you've got that time with them.
Yeah. Although today I'm in my office, but because I got a bunch of stuff after this. But generally, yeah, I get up early and go down to the basement. I come to the office.
I mean, I thought for a second, boy, his kids are hardcore if they're getting up at 4:30 to start their day. They have a work ethic like you can't.
I got an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old. So no, they're nothing hardcore. They're just they're in the cute phase.
But so I was thinking about this. You know, I know that Bridge Bio is in California, of course, and that you went to Stanford. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, no, I was born in Boston, but I don't remember anything of it because we moved to Rochester, Minnesota when I was about 3 weeks old, and I grew up there. So Rochester, Minnesota, southeast Minnesota, toward the Mayo Clinic is, and I spent most of my formative years there.
How was that? I mean, it's not often that I have someone from Minnesota on the show.
Certainly from Rochester. It was idyllic. You know, I mean, I think it's interesting to reflect on it a little bit. It's it was a small town back then, probably less than 60,000-70,000 people. Lots of diversity of thought, socioeconomic diversity, no racial diversity. I think we were the racial diversity for the most part, but it was a really I think great community to grow up in. I made a lot of good friends that I'm still close to there, and that was kind of simple living.
how is it? So you just said no racial diversity. How is it that your family was there in the first place?
My father's a physician researcher in the area of nephrology, so the Mayo Clinic was there, and I think it attracted him, and he's been there for over 30 years, really.
That's the reason why the move from Boston.
Yeah.
That job. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So this leads into my next question. So your dad is a physician and a researcher?
Yes. Yeah. He runs a lab. Yeah.
So did that sort of lead you into thinking about a life in science or medicine?
Yeah, I think obviously you're deeply affected by what you grow up around. And I grew up around a lot of examples of people working on basic science, trying to translate basic science into stuff that could be meaningful for people and help people with it. So certainly that was an influence on me. I was never, although there was reasonable pressure for me to become a doctor, I was never going to go down that route. I'm queasy and probably didn't have the skill set for it. But by and large, I certainly must have been affected by growing up in a community where healthcare was such a big part of everyone's value system.
I mean, you said that you could, the idea of translating research into medicine, was your father also, was his research also translational in that way? Or just because he saw patients that he thought that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably one of the differentiating features of doing research in a place like the clinic, and there's many great examples of this across academe, is that you get to take what you're learning in the physician setting. Sometimes you'll see an odd case, sometimes you'll see an interesting manifestation and get into the molecular pathophysiology of disease X or Y, and then start doing research on it. So yeah, certainly he connected the two. And did a lot of seminal work in phosphatonins and bone mineral density and 125 alpha hydroxy vitamin D, just a bunch of stuff that also affected much of his practice too.
Yeah. So you were surrounded by it growing up.
Yeah, for sure.
And what about siblings? Did you have siblings? Or do you have siblings?
I have a younger sister, about 2 years younger.
Is she in medicine at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a smart one. She's a physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering, oncologist, and she's a badass.
And what about your mother? Was she also in the sciences at all, or yeah, looks like
my mom was trained in economics actually, and stayed at home with us for the most part when we were younger, and then I started working in development at the Mayo Clinic. So now she does a lot with the Mayo Clinic Foundation and helping to raise funds for Mayo. So it's a big Mayo family in Rochester.
Yeah.
I mean, Rochester basically is like the Mayo Clinic
and their families.
There used to be an IBM plant there that was of import, but that sort of wound down over time. So I bet if you surveyed Rochester now, by far and away the largest employer has to be Mayo Clinic.
Right. Right. So as you're growing up around this, you've got a mother who's sort of leans towards economists maybe, and your father who's in medicine. Were your interests, I mean, did you think, okay, well, I'm going to go into medicine one way or another, or science, or did you have other interests, when you were younger, maybe you thought, I don't know, sports or I don't know.
Well, sports were off the table, just given my general athletic ability. But I don't remember really thinking that much about it. On the one hand, I think that there is always an expectation growing up in a pretty hardcore household that you're going to go on and do something of importance or something that uses whatever skills you have to try to better society. but you know, whether it would be a doctor or a lawyer, you know, those are traditional, like, you know, toolkits for a family like ours, or an engineer. I hadn't really thought about that growing up. It was more just trying to stick with what was interesting to me.
Yeah. So science was interesting to you.
Oh, certainly from early days, I was captivated by certain aspects of science, chemistry and biology. You know, it took a long time for me to understand that I was not going to be the next Linus Pauling or something like that. But I was captivated by physical chemistry and those types of concepts from actually a pretty young age.
I mean, do you remember why? Like, why, at what point it clicked in that you thought, oh, this is fascinating to me? I mean, it's often, you know, that you understand the way the world works or the way that the body works or, you know, something like that.
That's a good question. I don't think that there's some people who have who are trying to understand the physical world around them, the tinkerers, the, you know, take apart a radio type person.
Yeah.
That was never me. I guess I just really enjoyed logic systems. Like, I mean, that would be my, you know, I wouldn't have turned to that growing up, but just kind of like a great book, you know, a cool system around chemistry or biology. It seems so foreign. It's like, this is how a cell works, but you're not interfacing with a cell on a day-to-day basis, but it feels interesting. You can get captivated by it. It's like a story. Yeah, I don't know. Those self-conforming, interesting, logical systems were all something that captivated me.
Yeah.
I wasn't like in the Westinghouse competition when I was in third grade or anything. Sort of makes it sound like I grew up in this, but this super academic, like, it was, yes, my father was an academic and, you know, great physician, but it wasn't, I wasn't geared into it like that, probably up until high school, right, where I really started to get intense about my love for science. But before that, it was just, you know, the superior subject of amongst many others that I enjoyed. But I wasn't like doing chemistry kits on the side. I was watching TV.
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up in the Midwest, so like, you know, watch TV. I've seen every, you know, Who's the Boss or whatever, Saved by the Bell. It wasn't like this massively learned upbringing.
Yeah. You're saying you had a typical Midwestern upbringing, but you happen to like, I mean, when you said the thing about systems, which it sounds like maybe what was attractive was the ability to put order to the world in a way that a cell works in this way. There's a system that operates inside the cell and it does this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I actually, you know, those goofy like MBTI tests that you can take your personality
test,
the last one is J versus P, and I'm extraordinarily disorganized. I mean, you can see journals everywhere and books everywhere. I'm not an organized person, so you wouldn't think I would test J, which is the more organized side of it. And I'm, you know, I'm sure some experts will tell me I'm wrong on this, but I thought that was all about organization. But I do think in the way I think about things, I like to think about problems in a very structured way and almost like it's just like dive into the logic tree. And when the logic tree all sort of works, it's amongst the happiest moments for me. That's why I loved engineering and just the general approach of that type of thinking. So I think I've liked that since the get-go, just sort of a nice, tidy little world that you can get into, and it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. So that makes sense that you went to, well, you said you sort of maybe really keyed in high school. You thought, okay, now I know I want to go into science. Did you think already chemical engineering in that way? I mean, that was what you went to Stanford for.
Yeah, no way. No. So I actually went to boarding school for high school. And the whole reason I fell in love with chemistry was a person, and this is a recurring theme in my life. It was Tama Macabella. He was my high school chemistry teacher. He was an amazing man, a totally amazing teacher, totally amazing individual, educator. Really just a great hero to me in many ways. And I fell in love with his class. I fell in love with what he was teaching. And I really like honed in on chemistry at that time. Could have gone anyway, which way. Could have gone, to world biology. Could have gone, honestly, outside of science. I mean, there's a lot of other topics that you know, take the tools of science or logic and apply them in meaningful ways. So it just turned out that he was there. He was my teacher and had a huge effect on me. So I got super deep into chemistry in high school.
Did you know that you wanted to go to Stanford? Was the program the thing that drew you there? Or did you apply to, you know, lots of schools and Stanford was the, I don't know, the top school or something?
No, I didn't know that I wanted to go to Stanford, I guess. I had been thinking that I wanted to do chemistry, and I think Stanford had an early decision at that time. I didn't feel like applying to 1,000 different colleges, so I just did Stanford early decision. When I got in, I said, great, let's go. Huh. I mean, I was interested in the West Coast. You know, I'm from the Midwest, so the East Coast where I'd gone to boarding school was interesting, but I thought maybe let's try something else.
I see.
Stanford obviously had a great, you know, I mean, it was an unbelievable place. So I lucked out and went there.
Where was the boarding school?
It was right outside of Boston.
Ah, okay. So you went back to the Boston area, which you didn't remember, as you said, but
yeah,
you know, it must have seemed somewhat familiar, maybe based on family stories or something. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so then it's down to California for college.
Yeah, yeah.
And you sort of rolled that, I think, into a master's program.
They had this amazing program that they probably still do called the co-term program. I can't remember co-term or what, but you could do 5 years and do your undergraduate and master's. And it just turns out that I had done a bunch of the work for the master's over the course of the 4 years. So I had this extra year where I just got to take an unbelievable variety of classes. And I took, I was privileged to be working in another great mentor to me, Steve Chu's lab at the time at Stanford. And I took a ton of biology classes during that year, biophysics classes. I took a human behavioral biology with Sapolsky, which was a mind-blowing class. I got to take a lot of things that just weren't in the chemical engineering criteria and were sort of outside of what I otherwise would have studied. Because then when I went back to the PhD after that, it was the same, you know, numerical methods, thermodynamics, things of that nature that are more traditional chemical engineering. But I benefited greatly from that extra year. It was I got a broad smattering of great classes, quantum chemistry, with Tester, I guess. I had a lot of great professors and great courses with them.
Did Steve Chu teach you anything that you remember that you're like, okay, that is, you know, he's quite well known.
Yeah. Oh yeah. He was unbelievable. I mean, there are a couple of things that struck me from his lab. Number one was, at that time he was doing single molecule FRET and he had just this unbelievable squad of, postdocs and graduate students, Chuck Schroeder, Xiaowei Zhang, who I had the privilege of working with. She's a professor at Harvard now, TJ Ha, who went to University of Illinois. And just the rigor with which they approached every problem that they were trying to solve. I mean, down to the level of trying to model why quenching, for instance, occurs in the context of trying to understand single molecule vesicle fusion. It was just very, so he drilled super deep. He was really a genius as far as I can tell. Secondly, just the work ethic in his lab was really, it was great. You just go there on Saturdays, you go there on Sundays, people were there, it was buzzing. I mean, that type of, that excitement, I mean, some people say, oh man, like, you know, that's not a great balance, but it is a great balance when you're just totally in love with this stuff. And he was totally in love with this stuff. You would be there on Saturday, he'd already be there. With the music going on in his office and reading a book and you know, you have like another Nobel laureate in there, like a Kornberg or something like that. And they'd be talking about us. He's just so much excitement for the science. And then, you know, I remember one time I was talking to him, it was maybe like a Saturday or something like that again. And I was reading something about, I think it was like Gödel's incompleteness theorem, something totally philosophical. It was, does the whole logic system that we've put forth within the realm of math and science make sense here? And I mean, he just sat down and talked to me about it and how complex number theory might be addressing some of those issues for like an hour. I mean, he is a real, I haven't spoken to him in many years, but he's a really remarkable thinker. Yeah, absolutely.
I love that thought that, you know, people say, well, good God, they're in the lab on Saturdays and Sundays, but it isn't a grind if that's the thing you're most excited to do that day. It's where you want to be.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about him was he could get into, I was no expert. I was just some, you know, bumbling around undergrad. So first of all, it was a real gift that he even let me in. But he would get into experimental details and he'd be able to step back and educate and explain even the most basic principles. You know, that's consistent with the fact that he is really just so gifted. But a really remarkable man. Yeah. I felt very privileged to spend some time in his lab.
Yeah. So it seems like at this point you're maybe considering a life in academia. I mean, you went to get your PhD after this.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was your plan.
That was definitely my plan. Yeah. Yeah. No, I you know, academe was the thing for me. I didn't do any jobs in industry, period, up and through I was done with my PhD. And that was very much my plan, was to try to, you know, I think I probably went to Stanford hoping that I would become, again, some sort of a great physical chemist, or hardcore basic chemistry researcher, but it became pretty apparent toward the end of my tenure there that I wasn't at that level. I wasn't ever going to make a contribution at that, you know, Stephen Chu like level, which, you know, that makes sense. And so then I was like, well, but I still want to be an academic. There's maybe something to contribute. And at that time I was really interested in the intersection of biology and, you know, more quantitative engineering principles. And MIT had a really, really cool set of professors exploring that intersection. And especially, you know, one of my then heroes in research, who I had, again, had then the privilege to do my PhD with, Doug Offenberger, along with Dane Wittrip and a few others. They were kind of pioneering this biological engineering division at MIT. So I was lucky enough to get over there and work with them. And it was an amazing experience.
That concept you just mentioned, I've heard other people on the show talk about this, where they go to school, they go to college, even for undergrad, and they think that they are going to be, I don't know, the world's greatest mathematician. And then they come across somebody who actually is the world's greatest mathematician, and they go, oh, I'm actually good at this, but I'm not at that level. And maybe I need to focus on something else. But so did that, when you got to MIT, did that idea solidify that you were good as an academic, but weren't?
I already had that in college. I mean, that was, you know, I wouldn't say college was a very, I think I had a great time in college, but that was a tough set of, I can't remember, some trimesters or whatever, where you're just coming to grips with that. And it sounds just ridiculously arrogant to even suspect that you might have that ability, but every child dreams or whatever.
And exactly.
Every kid who's been rolling along, you sort of, you know, when you're kind of like a plumpy Indian kid, like I was, you derive a lot of your self confidence from being super good at a thing, and for me that was chemistry and et cetera. And then when you realize, damn, I'm not even close to these kids, and there's no way you could work your way out of that hole or anything, you're just gifted. I think that's tough. I'm glad I went through it so early in my life. And then by the time I got to MIT, I wasn't even concerned about it. And by the time I got to MIT, it was more, how do I work on a problem that I can make a difference in? And wasn't so worried about the fact that there were likely to be, you know, many people in my program who were much more gifted than I was. And there certainly were.
Yeah.
So it was great. Absolutely. I mean, you know, once you gain comfort with that, sky's the limit, because you just like put yourself into milieus where you're just learning constantly from people. And that's what I mean, you know, just one of the ideas that we have here at Bridge is like a swarm of just super smart people.
Yeah.
And everyone kind of has a humility. It's not a superstar organization in the sense that I think we have a lot of superstars, but there's no one person who we hew around. It's like, this is the person that made us, you know, great or whatever. It's just a bunch of really smart people, and you're learning from them, and everyone has the humility to understand that no one knows everything, And that's kind of why I also like drug discovery and development too, is that it is sort of like the ultimate team sport. So anyway, you know, that was kind of a, it was an interesting time, but yeah, by the time I got to MIT, I was fine with my mediocrity.
Well, listen, I mean, I don't think that's fair to say. You just had to readjust where you're going to aim yourself.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, whatever it is, everyone, I mean, I don't know if everyone goes through it, but I mean, I don't belabor the point, but after you've gone through it, it's a healthy thing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I was in a tiny high school, and I just was great at physics and math. And I got to college, and I thought, oh, there are people who are way better at physics and math than I am here, for sure, right?
Yeah.
And then you just realize, well, you have to really find out what the thing you actually are quite good at. And anyway, so you finished.
How did it affect you, though?
I decided I was not going to be a math major.
Yeah.
I mean, I realized that there people were. I mean, I could do math, but I was never going to come up with theories.
Yeah.
And
do you remember the moment that you decided, like, you were like, well, I'm not going to do this. This is not going to.
Well, there were two things. One was my first test ever in college. So in high school, I had just gotten A's all the time by really kind of just cramming the night before and going in and acing the test kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I did that for my first test in college, and I got a D on it. And it was something like art history. I mean, it wasn't like, I just didn't, and I couldn't believe that I'd done so poorly. And I went in to see the professor and I said, listen, I studied like 5 hours last night. And he said, 5 hours? You know, you have to study an hour for every hour of class. You should have studied 15 hours over the previous 2 weeks for this test. And I thought, oh, I need to really up my game here. And I did, of course. But it was so, as you said, it was like informative and useful. Yeah. But there's that moment. I was like, oh, this is a different place than where I was. And those old rules don't apply. And you have to do something different here. So,
yeah.
But so when you finish the PhD, then the idea of an academic life is already behind you.
No, what happened during my PhD? No, the PhD in many ways reinforced my love for academia. I was working in a field that was somewhat novel at the time, systems biology, some of the modeling techniques that Doug Laufenberger, who I worked with and pioneered, and others were just coming to the fore in the major scientific literature. But I, you know, MIT is quite an entrepreneurial place, and those were sort of go-go times. I was there between 2002 and 2006.
Yeah.
So I got bit by that entrepreneurial bug, and we raised a little bit of money against an idea. It wasn't a particularly good idea, but it was for a low-cost gene chip, and ultimately, you know, fittered the money away. Didn't really turn the idea into anything of value. That was the first time I was kind of like, huh, there's a big gap between the skill set that I understood and application in the real world. And I think for me, because it was clear that I wasn't going to make a seminal difference in academe in the sense that I was going to discover the structure of a new scientific revolution, I had already put that to bed. The hope was that my work would generate things that would help society in some small way. And seeing the gap of like, okay, here's an interesting idea. It was one of the best ideas that I'd seen at MIT. And then like how difficult it was still to translate that into something that mattered for people. I figured I should learn more about how that translation occurs. So that took me into business. And kind of like, I mean, it was kind of a, like when I look back on my life, it was like academia, 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 and then all of a sudden, boom, you're going into business after PhD.
Right.
Especially having studied with Doug, who I think is well known for having placed a lot of great professors in academia. But so I guess and from a narrative basis, it seems more severe than it actually was in my head, which was kind of this gradual evolution of being like, okay, I'm not going to be the Lasker award winning, you know, whatever it is. And then, okay, I'm sort of at this intersection of application and theory, but I'm in the lab. And now, okay, I just discovered there's some failings for me there too. So let me go and try to work on that in another context that where I could learn a bit more about business. So it felt more gradual in my head, but it seems more severe when I look back on it.
Yeah. But so you went to McKinsey, right? I think.
Yeah.
So was that part of that? Thinking, okay, well, listen, I mean, it's harder to start a company than I thought it was. Maybe McKinsey is going to teach me, I'm going to learn stuff there, how to actually run businesses, how to make them, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what's funny is I thought that going in. I mean, I don't think McKinsey is the place to go to learn how to run a startup for sure. Those things are very, very different. But what McKinsey did teach me was a lot about how the broader business environment works, meaning how does the healthcare ecosystem work? And even to this day, I think, you know, when I look around, I sort of understand how, you know, the payer system works and how an LDN is designed and what a distributor's business model is, and how to think about all of that, which is important in terms of your product's going to live somewhere in a broader healthcare system where it's being valued. And so that was a valuable learning. It wasn't like, how do I run my next startup? It was more, how does healthcare broadly work, and what problems could be productively solved by biotech or pharma within that space.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Oh, I see. And so, but how long were you at McKinsey?
I was there 3.5 years.
Yeah, almost 4 years. Good amount of time. Yeah. What's the thing that brought you out of it?
Well, I met my wife in New York. We were both, I was in the New Jersey office at the time, but living in Manhattan, and she was in New York. Actually, I first met her in high school.
Really?
But it took her a while to come around, I guess, 15 years or something.
Did you look her up in New York? Were you still in touch?
Yeah, no, we met through a mutual friend,
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was lucky for me. And then she decided to move to the West Coast to come and work at Apple. And so for a while I was sort of commuting back and forth. And then I said, this is like anything, is, you know, a small change in your life. It makes you pick your head up and say, well, this was just supposed to be an educational moment for me. Now what, you know, where do I want to take some of what I learned in graduate school and some of what I learned business, and how do I apply it? And the opportunity to work for Charles Holmesy at Third Rock came along, and I snapped at it. So,
oh, that's what happened.
I jumped at it. Whatever.
So Third Rock came after that. They reached out to you somehow and said, "Here's a man with a PhD."
I had known. I knew a couple people who were working there. I know Chris Varma, who was working on the East Coast. And somehow I'd gotten to know him over time. So I met a few of the partners in Boston. And then a friend of mine, Jake Bauer, who ended up being, he was at Third Rock for a long time and then was the chief business officer at MyoKardia. He was on the West Coast and he was leaving to go help run a company. So he said, look, there's an opening here. Why don't you get in touch with some of the folks? And I did. And it just became apparent that I've been very lucky to work with that squad. So yeah, that's what happened.
Okay. But I think there's one more step in there. I think did you work at MyoKardia too for a while?
Well, I worked at, well, so Third Rock's model is that you, it's not really like an investment shop. It's, I mean, you know, it is a VC, but in as much as it sets its own companies up, you tend to jump in for a little while and then come out. So I was at Third Rock. Charles and I put together MyoKardia.
That's what I thought.
I jumped in, helped operate it for a little while. So did Charles. Charles was the CEO until the permanent management team came on. And then I jumped back into Third Rock.
That's what I thought. Okay. Yeah. I figured that you got to MyoKardia from Third Rock and then came back out. So then you're in Third Rock and I'm assuming that this concept for BridgeBio somehow came out of your work at Third Rock.
Half did. Yeah. So, I mean, I joined Third Rock because, and this is where it all starts to, I guess, come together in my head, at least, which is the love for logical systems, some training in, you know, in engineering at the interface of quantitative sciences and biology, and then some understanding of business. To me, the place where it was most aptly applied was this area of genetic disease. And what I mean by that is genetic disease is kind of the logic tree of diseases where you can connect dots from genetic aberrance to protein driver to molecular pathophysiology symptoms. And you can start to draw blueprints in and around how one might target the disease at its source. And that's what Charles was working on when I joined. He was working on sickle. And then we sort of asked, where else could we go with that concept, targeting well-described diseases at their source? And that, to me, became just the big passion was that's what led to MyoKardia. And that's what led to a whole lot of other ideas that we had. And so half of what became BridgeBio was really this concept of there's a lot of great ideas in this space and we just want to do it at scale. That was that. And then the other half was reading Andrew Lowe's paper in Nature Biotech about the concept of financing something at scale.
Megafund.
And how the megafund. Yeah, exactly. That that was a really interesting moment. And I thought, okay, if we can put those two things together, can actually build something that could hopefully be really pragmatic and at scale help a bunch of patients in these areas of genetic medicine. So that's how it all came together.
This is fascinating to me. When I was looking at BridgeBio, there's like three big areas that I think are really, really interesting to talk about. And so the first one is you have on your board, Charles Homsey's on the board, right?
Yep.
And so is Andrew Lowe.
Yep.
So he must have been brought in, you must have helped set up the business plan with his thinking about at scale. Yep. And maybe we should talk a little bit about just the megafund idea that he sort of put out there, which was kind of, you know, drug development is super expensive. Everybody knows that. Cancer is proving incredibly hard to crack. And the more we find out about it, the more difficult it becomes almost. And his idea was, we can't throw $200 million at cancer. Let's throw $30 billion at cancer.
Right.
And you'll have as much money as you'll ever need, but you'll spread the risk around all these assets so that the fund won't really be in danger if something fails. And eventually out of it, the money will probably be, you know, depleted in the end, but you will have three or four new cancer drugs that might be really, really life-changing. And it was a super interesting thing. And it has sort of shifted a little bit, I think, the thinking around funding, possibly a little bit already. Do you agree with that?
Totally. I mean, I think it's just starting to shift it because there were a lot of companies, and we're not the only one, that were born of the idea, but we never quite, like, I mean, this is why I say BridgeBio is just getting started today. We're finally today starting to get an approach to scale that we talked about when we started the company and to take advantage of some of the concepts that Andrew had put forth. And the core concept, which you nicely described, is that you're living in a jackpot industry, and meaning, you know, the expected return is positive, the modal return is negative, and you've got a really wacky way of financing it. You just, you know, you've got people who think they can make the right call. And you know, they're smart people. I mean, I have the privilege of working with a lot of smart people, but they're generally going to be more wrong than they are right, just because this is an incredibly hard set of problems to solve. So in most industries like that, you finance a big basket, understanding what the historical probability of technical success or commercial success or whatever it is. And in doing so, you can basically hive off default risk so that you can bring a lot more capital into the space. And that's the underappreciated, I think, aha moment, which is there's $170 trillion of capital in the world. There's whatever, 70 trillion, I don't know what it is, Andrew knows the number. There's $40 trillion of capital in the equity markets itself. So when people say, wow, biotech has a $1.6 trillion or $1.8 trillion market cap right now in aggregate, like who cares? It's a small amount. It's tantamount to what it's producing in the GDP. So the ability of biotech to help more and more people with more and more financing if they just had the right profile, which is you're not going to lose your money and you might make some money here. If you can create that type of profile, you could bring debt investors in who account for much larger of the portion of the economy than do, you know, equity investors that want to take binary risk and stuff like that. And in doing so, you can let the science go. You can let the science speak for itself and not, you know, what's sexy or like what the narrative is or anything like that. And that's what I thought the glory of what Andrew was positing was. And I think, like our last financing was all, basically equity linked debt. And I think we're getting closer and closer to this concept of now with a diversified pipeline, I don't have to necessarily pitch one product. I can pitch the shape of the portfolio to some people and then they get excited about it.
That's it. So when I was looking at, what is the proposition for BridgeBio? And let me put forth what I think it is, right? Having looked at it. It's the idea that there are companies that are put together around like a really interesting piece of biology. We came across this in the lab, we spun out of university, and we think this is great. Or even here's a disease that we think we can attack. We're going to go after Angelman's syndrome or something.
Yep.
And that's another way. What BridgeBio has put together is, and I think even maybe the company has put this idea out, that it's a kind of a money ball idea where the company is going to go find what's considered a Moneyball, for anyone listening, is the book by Michael Lewis about the Oakland Athletics, where they would find baseball players who were undervalued, but quite good. And together, they put together a team that was spent less than anyone else and was a good team. So the idea is that you're going to find these assets that are somewhat undervalued. They're either languishing in academia. Maybe they've been shelved at pharma because there wasn't resources for it. Apply value to them. And then eventually, hopefully get the real value, which is the thing is approved and there for patients. So when you look at that as a concept of getting these assets in that are undervalued by using the scale that you mentioned, the resources that you have, applying value to them, the company is actually a financial proposition and not a scientific one. Am I correct in that?
Well, I don't think we advance that money ball thing, although it's an interesting headline and I did love the book. But I'll tell you where it's analogous and I'll tell you where it's different. I think that the purpose of our company is super simple. It is to create and to maximize the number of new meaningful medicines for patients with genetic disease that otherwise would not have been created.
Yeah.
It's that simple. And almost everything that we worked on early days, everything you see late in our pipeline, is effectively ideas that were sitting on the shelf, mechanism of disease ideas, often with like an early hook onto how you might target the disease at its source, that were somewhere in some academic's laboratory. And we said, how do we translate that insight into a medicine that matters? So that translation, that early work, reading those journals, all that stuff, that is part and parcel of what animates us, because that's how you get to the meaningful impact on patients. So in that sense, the company is a science company through and through. I mean, we are let your science speak. This is hopefully rigorous science. This is no bullshit science, just like Moneyball. I don't know that much about Moneyballs or much about baseball, but they were like, it was a love of baseball. It was just like not a bullshit love of baseball. It wasn't this guy went to the, it was actually looking at the facts, whatever those facts were, sabermetrics in their case. For us, it's just forget whether the person is decorated in this way or whether they are at this school or whether these two science papers came out or this other thing got the, let's just get down to the bones of what we understand about this disease and whether or not we have an ability to make an impact. And sometimes that's going to be in small markets, which we can make profitable given our structure. And sometimes it's going to be in larger markets. Okay. So that being said, I think where it's analogous to Moneyball maybe, or where it's analogous to a financial proposition, is that there is no limit, I think, a priori to what the company could do in terms of innovation that could help patients. Meaning, I'm not saying that I'm just an siRNA company, nor am I saying I'm just a Angelman's or a CNS inherited disease. I'm saying everything within the span of genetic disease, and genetic disease really is a moniker for a higher probability of technical success, because
right.
I can draw that engineering blueprint. So maybe it's not just genetic disease. Maybe in the future there are proteomic platforms where, you know, the protein variants, you know, adequately quantitatively describes the symptom, you know, the symptoms or the symptomatic output. And I say, okay, I'm going to go after that because I understand that is a target. It's really to say, what are the high probability of technical success diseases where no one else is working? Because if someone else is working everywhere, then I'm fine with our company just saying, great, like job done, you know, but that's not happening. Certainly most of what we go after, because we go after it so early and we're so kind of, you know, hand in hand with a program 3, 4, 5 years before it gets to the clinic. No one's working that early. So yeah. that's how I see the company. And that's why I think, you know, when you say it's a financial proposition, I don't think of it that way, but I think it's a proposition that has no natural boundaries to how much we can take on. Could we take on another double the pipeline? Maybe, if we're successful.
Yeah. So first off, Neil, I don't mean to imply it's not a scientific company at all. What I mean is, I asked it wrong.
I think because I am defensive about that. But I do think that you are right in saying there's something interesting about the scale that
yes.
we're trying to go for.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it different. It's not a traditional biotech in the sense that it's not the biotech narrative that you generally hear. Like we're
100%.
Yeah, this disease or this modality.
Right. And then the other thing, and when I say it's a financial proposition, I'm saying when you go to investors and they're excited, investors are there for the financial proposition. And without the money, the companies don't exist. We all know that.
Okay.
So when you go to these investors and say, look, we're going after monogenic diseases. We are going after diseases where the gene has been identified and we know there's a direct causal link between the gene and the disease. That de-risks the program for the investors. The risks are twofold. One is this the right target and is it druggable? You're saying we know the target. So now our risk is it druggable? And that I think also is appealing for investors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, broadly you think about how do drug programs fail? There's, you know, target risk, like you nail the target, but it turns out not to be important in the overall pathophysiology of the disease. There's tox risk, asymptomatic tox can have, there's manufacturing risk. And then there's obviously competitive or strategic risk. I mean, all we're doing is we're taking away the target risk because the target almost through a series of human clinical experiments has been validated. Now, that doesn't mean I can definitely drug it at the right time in a patient's life or I'll trial it at the right duration, or I can even tease out the right functional endpoint. But it does dramatically decrease the target risk when you've got this map of, you know, what we call genotype, phenotype.
Yeah. So this, the other thing that I thought about was, you know, as you said, this typical biotech narrative is, hey, we're super small. We've got this great piece of biology, whatever, going after this asset, and we're going to be fast and we're going to be nimble. And that's how we separate ourselves from pharma. And that's the joy of biotech. And that is why biotech is more innovative than pharma is. But you guys just bought Eidos.
Yeah,
you brought that in house. It has a phase 3 asset. It's TTR. The target is TTR. It's could have a great value. I think the total value of that company was like $1 billion. And when you look at that, you go, well, that sounds like something that a pharma company might do.
Go ahead.
One other thing is secondly, you guys are going to market your own drugs, which is the smartest thing you can do for your revenue stream for sure.
Yeah,
but that is something that pharma typically does better than biotech. And so then the question becomes, are there hurdles in BridgeBio's future that might make it less nimble and fast like a biotech wants to be because of scale, because of marketing? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So I'm going to show you a book in a second, but so many good questions in that. Number one, let me just actually reject your hypothesis for a moment that biotech does have a higher ROI and higher probability of technical success when it comes to drug discovery. Is that because it's extraordinarily nimble? I don't think so. I would say BridgeBio is much nimbler at the program level than your average biotech. And I'll tell you why. Your average biotech is not a startup. it's just a new company. It's just, you know, some VC puts $100 million into it and hires a bunch of people from pharma, and they come in, they build this massive bureaucracy even before they have a development candidate. And it's like a mini pharmaceutical company. The reason it does better generally is that they've thought carefully about an area of biology. Sometimes they've brought great academic founders in who are super incented to just get that thing right. Right. So that's why biotech works in my mind, is like
that hardcore
alignment of incentives and focus. So what we have is we have that at each one of our program levels, but we got it hooked up to a central proxy, if you will, that makes it even faster and even nimbler. When it definitely doesn't work, we shut it down. When something is working, we can accelerate it a lot more quickly. But all of the incentives, all of the, you know, the hardcore doing is decentralized in our model. It's not me saying, you know, okay, guys, like, you know, how are you going to go about this TSC1 non-human primate study? So scientists actually know that disease and have been working on it for 20 years that are driving that. So it's like a collection of biotech activity inside of a broader ecosystem. Now, you asked a good question. As we scale, now you scale that decentralized model on the R&D side, I don't think you get less nimble. In fact, you get more nimble. So that was a book I was going to show you is by Jeffrey West called Scale. Have you ever seen this? Anyway, he's the president of the Santa Fe Institute. And he talks about why companies, by and large, as they scale, go away and don't achieve superlinear growth, but they achieve sublinear growth. And the reason for it is that they tend not to hew to a decentralized model where you have different pods of activity and then those pods grow into other pods of activity. Rather, they become more and more centralized, taking advantage not of returns to scale, but economies of scale, savings. And that inherently limits the growth of the system because you've got the centralized command and control type thing. And I think it's appropriate for some things. Certainly you see that in big pharma, but that's not what we're doing. We've got this massively decentralized organization. I think where the rubber will meet the road though is commercial, where we are marketing stuff. And then you ask yourself, well, is that going to make us more or less nimble? The assertion, well, we have to prove it, is going to make us more nimble, because what does revenue do? Revenue allows you to do more and more research and be less and less open to the vagaries of the capital markets to do it. I mean, you know, if you have a real products tend to, in bad times and good times, trade at some multiple of their revenue. Therefore, you have the ability to continue to take, and they tend to be profitable. So you can take that, you know, cash flow and plow it into new ideas that hopefully generate value for patients at scale. So that's kind of the vision. I mean, you know, a few people have done it. Regeneron, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. There's not a whole lot of companies that make the transition, but we're going to give it a shot.
I think what your answer is we've already thought about this, Brady. That's your answer.
No, it's true. But I mean, it is sort of what animates the whole model. Is part of it was, how do we bring a new type of investor in? Part of it is, how do you build a new type of biotech that to me feels like a true startup, like where you've got small teams that are really incented to just get their thing right, but you've got collections of them under an umbrella and everyone's innovating at the same time. And you're just going back to Steve Chu, like your labs are packed on Saturday and Sunday and like staff meetings are happening at all hours of the day because people are so excited by what's going on. And I just did not see that in biotech as much as I saw it in other sectors of the economy, because it tended to be, for a wide variety of good reasons, very, very experienced game where people were literally like retiring into biotech or retiring into the startup world. And that's not the vibe here.
So this sets up perfectly this last question I want to ask you about. This, you know, the reason why biotech exists is venture capitalists had been happy to sink money into companies that made widgets or pants or cars. But what happened is they realized that you could actually put money into an experiment, which what biotech is a grand experiment. And sometimes those experiments pay out. And that became a model that worked. And that is what gave rise to this industry. It's the thing that separates the American biotech industry from the rest of the world, frankly, is all this VC capital that's available for it. So that was an evolution in financing. And it's equally as important to what happened to this industry as all the great science that came out, you know, the first antibody research, et cetera. So my question is, when you look at something like BridgeBio or Centessa, we just saw that spun out of Medici, right? So Medici spun out this conglomerate called Centessa, which is 10 biotechs put together, and they seeded it with $250 million. Yep. And the question is this another evolution of the financing model for biotech?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I know people fret about it, but I think the more capital, the better in this space. There's so much to do for patients, and there's so many good ideas. You know, the traditional venture capitalist might say, and I've heard this before, oh, there's too much capital in the space, or, you know, there's a lot of bad ideas being funded. There's a lot of great ideas still sitting on the shelf. You know, there's tens of thousands of patents and NIH grants occurring every year, and we're founding like 150 new companies a year, 200 new companies a year. So the opportunity is massive, and the hope is these new models, by bringing in new types of investors, will continue to broaden the scope with which we can play with science to see if we can help patients. And I think that that's like, you know, what's better than that?
Yeah. I mean, do people say, what's the fear when people say there's too much money in this sector right now?
I think, to be honest, I think the fear is greed, because right now when people are worried about the money is like glomming on to the same companies. So what I just said, like, if you look at the number of new companies that get founded every year, it's almost flat. It's flat line from 2007 all the way to today. Maybe it's slightly higher, but it's not that much more than a couple hundred. So all that's happening is you get massive rises in valuation. And who are most of the people that are putting that money to work? They're like venture capitalists who have a relatively, 3 to 5 year time horizon. They need to get in and they need to get out at a higher value. So I think the worry for them is that by the time they're getting in, the valuations are so high that, potentially they're not going to make as much money as they used to. But that's the wrong objective. Well, that's the right objective function for them. It's the wrong objective function for the industry. The industry's objective function should be, how many meaningful medicines are we going to make?
Right.
And how many meaningful medicines are we going to make, and can we make those profitably? On a base zero, right? I mean, so one way to consider it is like the valuation that I just described, whatever it is, let's just call biotech $1.8 trillion of market cap or whatever. That implies that you probably need something like, if the revenue multiple is 5x, you need like $40 billion of new products a year to meet that implied valuation. And maybe we're at, if we were at 60 approvals last year or so, and the peak year sales on that is like 400, whatever. We're at 224 billion. We're off. So someone's going to lose somewhere. Some of these biotechs that are here at this value are going to go down, and some are going to go up. And that's fine. And that's fair. And some people fret about those ever increasing valuations. But what I fret about is, how do we get more and more money into the early stage space? Because regardless of what valuation or pre-money is at, there are great ideas that could help patients that are literally sitting on shelves today and should be pushed forward and could make someone some money in the right context.
I mean, you just said 60 approvals, right?
Yeah, I think it was close.
Roughly. That's remarkable.
It's awesome. Totally agree. Yeah.
I mean, I always kind of thought the idea was, well, if there's so much money coming into this sector, what's going to happen is a bunch of people are going to lose their shirts, and then it's all going to pull back and there's not going to be any money left. And that's the fear. But I just don't know that that's, I don't know that's going to happen.
There are certain people that will obviously, not live up to the hype, and there'll be others that create great medicines. But I think by and large, we're in a very productive time in our industry. What was called Eroom's law has reversed, in as much as productivity or number of NMEs per dollar spent is going up for the first time in a long time. And that's in part because we're doing better with targets, and in part because we're subfractionating syndromes into real diseases that we can go after. And I think that the time feels like now to really do this work productively. So I agree with you. A lot of people fretted about the tech industry, whatever it was, 10, 12 years ago. And certainly there was a bubble, but there was more of a secular trend toward value creation there. Even though if you like DCF that whole industry, I guess, and a lot of it is like just makes money on advertising, the implied advertising market would be like twice the global product market. If you're like $2 spent for every $1 product, makes no sense. But the thought is there are going to be other ways to monetize those platforms. And my thought is there's going to be a lot of ways to help patients. And so we're just scratching the tip of it.
So to bring this back to you, so this after having heard about your background, this makes perfect sense to me, right? That your mother was sort of more into economics and finance. Your dad was a researcher. No wonder that you were so interested in the mega fund idea. And Andrew Lowe's an economist. And you've taken those sort of economist ideas, which is, in my opinion, sort of like economists are really good at calmly looking at the data, right? They're super good at that. And that makes sense that BridgeBio looks the way that it does. Do you agree? Like, I think it's a perfect reflection of the way maybe you think about maybe the world.
Well, maybe, but dramatically informed by some just wonderful mentors that I get to work with, like Andrew and Charles and Richard and Frank and all these guys. Yeah, but yeah, no, like any startup, I hope is kind of a reflection of what I find dear and interesting intellectually, and also just kind of the environment or the culture that I would want to have worked in.
Yeah.
Like it goes back to like working in Steve Chu's lab or working in Wolfenberger's lab, or that excitement is what I feel when I come to work. And so it's why I love it. It's why I think we're just getting started. And I think hopefully the members of BridgeBio feel that way too. It's that academic excitement. It's fun.
Just one final thing. You know, you said before that when you're at Third Rock, you sort of create a company, they go in for a while, and then they might come back out. But this sounds like, you know, this is not a one asset company. This is a big company now. You've got 250 employees, I think, or more.
Yeah, no, I think we have 32 programs, and we have 400 employees or so.
You could run this company for the next 20 years of your life if you wanted to. Is that kind of the goal?
The board let me. Yeah,
if they let you.
Yeah, no, I would. I mean, I'm having a blast, and I think that there's a lot to do. And like I said, as long as the objective function remains one where there's latent opportunity, meaning there's meaningful medicines that aren't being created that we could step in and help create, then I'd love to do this. And you know, until 70s or 80s. but the chances that I get to do that are you know, I mean, I don't know how long how long I can go before I make a monster mistake. But
yeah,
I'm trying.
Well, okay. listen, I really appreciate this. This is an invigorating talk. I loved it. Thank you.
No, thank you, Brady. I appreciate it.
I'm going to stop this. All right. There it is. Your first Rounders podcast with Neil Kumar. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I would like to say thanks to Neil for making the time to do this. Thank you to the Midwest Quiet for use of your music in this podcast. I will take some information, some more information on BridgeBio, the Megafund article by Andrew Lowe, and the book that Neil mentioned. I will put all that in our community page, which you can find off the homepage of Nature Biotech. If you'd like to talk about this podcast, our journal, or anything that we do, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @NatureBiotech. You're listening to this, or I'm releasing this, on March 1st. Spring is in the air. Vaccinations are happening. My father has been vaccinated. My stepmother has been vaccinated. My mother-in-law has been vaccinated. My teacher friends have been vaccinated. I have a dentist friend, he's been vaccinated. So it's happening. It's happening. Better times ahead. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you on the next one, and goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free.
warbyparker.com/covered.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.